Accession number 29954, reel number 7.
I was full of an adventure spirit. Again, probably unrealistic, but romantic, more romantic than anything else. But I did quite well. I was one of the, very quickly, one of the quickest radio signalers. And I wasn't very good at shooting, but I wasn't bad either. We had no assault courses, I believe, at Liss. So that was all. It was a 3 weeks course, and then we went up to, then we were sent up to Arisaig.
Just go back to Liss. Was that a house at Liss, or was it a camp?
That was a little estate. It was a beautiful house, yes, of course. What was so wonderful? We were suddenly in real rooms, with real beds, with people serving food, people making our beds. I'm not sure about that. No, I think we made our own beds, but the people changing our linen, and we had our things washed. I mean, it's civilization had actually caught up with us. We didn't have to wash things up after dinner, you know. We had a bath, a shower. It was wonderful. At the end of each day, we could have a proper bath. Well, there was only one bathroom, and we had to take turns, but there were only about 12 of us.
You were the only ones there, apart from the instructors.
The only ones there, apart from instructors. There's a wonderful man in charge, a captain. I can't think of his name at the moment. I've got his name in my diary, but I did remember his name. I really liked him. And I got to know the others very well. Theo Neumann had people. Theo Neumann was not liked a lot by people, and for all the wrong reasons, and I myself did not appreciate him at the beginning. First of all, he looked odd. He was bald. Most of his head was bald, but he had two large clumps of reddish hair on the right. He had this reddish hair everywhere, growing out of his ears, and he had an awkward face to boot and green eyes, and he could occasionally he would stutter a little. But he was extremely brainy. I didn't join in trying to laugh about him as some of the others did, because I found out that when he asked something and people say, what a silly question, I found out that I hadn't known the answer, and I suspected some of the others hadn't either. They just hadn't known that they didn't know. But he had a solicitor's brain, which I didn't know at the time. And I'd remembered an anecdote in the 88 company when we were still in Wales, in lumbering. On a Sunday, we were all told to make our beds, stand ready to attention. Because some colonel, lieutenant colonel, or general, who knows what, was coming to inspect us. And we all did. But then we found out afterwards, Theo had refused. He had looked up the king's rules and regulations, and they did not allow our Sunday to be disturbed. And he refused to make his bed and stand by his bed, so the sergeant major had him carried out, he was on his bed, carried out his mattress, palliasse, into the glass house, which was of course not a glass house, and told him he would be put on charge afterwards. But when the inspection was over, he was sent back to his hut, and he was never put on a charge, and that impressed me very much at the time, although I didn't get to know him properly. I had got to know him once before. I must tell you this about Theo Neumann. When we were stationed in the Bow Road, funnily enough, that word glass turning up again, in a school, Coburn School, which had huge glass windows, and we were on the ground floor, our palace is on the floor. And we were near the docks, and every night the Blitz was on, and the windows were shaking from the bombs dropping, not all that near, but near enough. And there was a young fellow called Kravitz who jumped up and said, "You'll see, we'll never survive this, we'll never survive this." And Theo Neumann said, "Calm down, Kravitz. Look, I'm sure we'll survive it." "No, we won't. No, you'll see." I said, "All right." You say, "You'll see. I'll make a bet with you. If we both survive it, you pay me 5 bob. But, and I'll be quite fair with you, if we both don't survive it, I pay you 5 bob. If you don't survive it and I do, I pay you 5 bob. If I don't survive it and you do, I pay you 5 bobs. You see, you've got 3 chances against my one. And that's, oh, all right. Now, I'd never forgotten that about Tail Island. But that was all we learnt. It was the first stage, the first time we did a fieldcraft exercise, which is a very, very simple one, approaching the estate, the little estate, which had a high hedge around it. Apparently, we were apparently seen from everywhere, and this captain clapped his hand together. I've never seen anything like it, he said. Every one of you could have been shot within seconds. But we learned. I don't think we did anything else except for pistol shooting there. I'm not even sure we learned pistol shooting there. It was a lot of introductory training. It'd be too difficult for me to remember exactly what we learned where, but I do know that we started learning the Morse code, and then we had these little tapping machines, but we had no radios yet. We were only given the sort of theory about it, about waves. And then that's about all I can tell you about LIS, I think.
Were you slowly getting to know each other as well?
Oh, we were getting to know each other very well. I became very pally with Walter Freud in particular, and Alan Grant. Those two became closer friends to me. We were the same age, and we became quite good friends, but we all got together, we all got to know each other very well. And we came to Arisaig, where the training was extremely tough. We were welcomed by a sergeant who was in charge of physical training. He welcomed us outside the door of this building and said, and told us he wanted us to know right away that we had to get up every morning by 7, or had to be up every morning by 7, outside there, gym shorts and gym shoes. And every morning we were running, he pointed up there, there was a hilly road. Every morning we were running a little bit further and a little bit faster. And we did for 3 weeks, and we felt it. Not only that, the moment you stepped off the road, everything was heather and everything was wet. And didn't matter how good your boots were and your socks were, within 2 or 3 minutes your feet were soaked. And there we had a fantastic assault course. I say fantastic. It was a really very good assault course. There was a little river, a little canal going through the estate, and there was a bridge over it. And we had to shoot. We learnt all kinds of shooting, pistol shooting. Perhaps that's where that was the only place where we learned pistol shooting. Because I remember we had to shoot at targets when we did an assault course. Part of it was always shooting at targets that would prop up somewhere. And we were told that the method we were taught was a new one. Not aiming and shooting, but pointing and shooting. And that was good for me, because I had never had a very firm hand. My hand was always, even since my youth, slightly shaky. So aiming, unless I rested it on something, I wasn't very good at. But pointing and shooting, I was quite good. I became much better after a while there. Now, I don't think we did pistol shooting at least, now that I remember it. And I remember one particular assault course in which we were running in pairs, and we were always timed. And apparently there was a file on each of us, and our achievements or non-achievements were entered. And on one occasion I was paired with Walter Freud. And part of the, after having got through the pistol shooting part of the assault course, we had to cross that canal, not over the bridge, but through the water. It was quite wide, and there was a piece of wood lying there ready for us, and Walter was supposed to pull me across. The idea was that one of us was wounded. Now the funny thing was that Jimmy Bennett, who was one of our training officers for the first time there, he remained with us for the rest of our training, threw gelignite into the canal from that little bridge quite nearby, and the blast hit my thigh, and I was wounded. I could not move my leg. And as we reached the other end, he really had pulled me. I could, just went a bit like this. Also, I touched something and it turned out to be a dead dog passing by, but the dog didn't mind. And as we reached the other end, I said, Walter, you go ahead, I can't run. But strangely enough, within seconds my feeling came back and I caught up with him, and we didn't do badly. I think we came third. I remember this particular assault course. There must have been many. I think we had one every third, fourth day.
Did you know much about... Did Walter Freud tell you much about himself? Or did you tell each other much about yourself?
No.
Did you know who he was?
On the contrary. I knew the name Freud vaguely because it was a famous name, but I had no idea about his grandfather or psychoanalysis. No idea at all. I can honestly say that I became friendly with Walter Freud because I liked him, and absolutely no other reason, because I was once reproached, you're friends because his grandfather is famous. Absolute rubbish. I knew nothing about it. Much later in our friendship, he gave me a book by one of his grandfather's books, and I read it. It was a case studies, and that was the first time I heard about Sigmund Freud. But I had him doing our training. I've been going a bit to and fro, but he invited me to his home a couple of times, and I met his father there. They lived somewhere northwest London. Well, the house is still a bit of a museum now, I think. When I say I met his father, that's an exaggeration, because his father sort of passed by, and Walter said, "This is my friend Eric," and he passed by. And that was Martin. Later on, I got to know much more about the family, because, in fact, I got to know much more after the war than I ever had known during the war. We knew very little about each other, very little. We just didn't ask. There was this whole atmosphere from the start of security. The less you know about each other, the better. And I think we all took it rather seriously. As far as I was concerned, there was nothing to know about me. Most of them got to know my mother because they always visited her when they went on leave. And they all liked my mother very much. She was a lovely woman. Everybody liked her. And then we did a lot of map reading there. It was very difficult to read maps in that sort of environment, because there were... Once you went off the road, there was nothing to go by. They're all little hills with a few locks in between. I remember one particular day trip where we had to take turns map reading, following a given route. And I remember I was very lucky because I was the first one. And that wasn't very difficult because I started from the road. But later it became so difficult. And when it was Theo Neumann's turn, he came to Captain Hughes, whom we got to know there, and who remained a friend of 12 of our lot forever and ever, still is alive. He led us through this, and when we got to the point where Theo Neumann had to take over, Theo Neumann came to him and showed him a sketch he had made of what it would look like where he took over, and it was fantastic. And he used merely the hashers, the outlines of the heights, something I could never do. I can never, if I couldn't see a church or anything like this, I tended to be lost. And it never happened, luckily, but I remember one occasion I saw a church when we did a map reading scheme later outside Northampton, and it was entirely the wrong church. Luckily, it was in the same direction where I had to go, so I found my way back. But Theo was fantastic. Another thing we did there, we were taken to Fort Williams and learned how to drive a railway engine, a locomotive. It was quite easy, oddly enough. And that's all I can remember of that, except for the last day when a piper played whilst we were eating. Oh, and I remember something else. Porridge every morning was salty. And I bought a lot of sweeteners. You couldn't get sugar, but you had these sweeteners. I put lots of them into the milk and poured lots of milk over the salty porridge, so it tasted quite sweet. You were going to ask me something?
Yes, two things. One was, where were you housed? What were you billeted in Arizona?
We were in the main house. I think this must have been a landed estate, because it had these huge grounds for the assault course behind the building. So, yes, and it was the entrance was straight from the road. Well, it was a big house, and we were in this house. I can't remember the actual quarters.
And the other thing, your mention of gelignite. Were you introduced to explosives?
Ah, that's the other thing we learned there. Yes, we learnt we learnt about explosives. Ah, that was something we started at Liss. We learnt that you had to. We were shown fuses. First, we learnt how to use to light a fuse, to cut it at an angle, light it, and learnt that it burned one centimeter per second, I believe. So we had a 5-centimeter fuse, and we lighted and put it in front of us and watched it. It was quite undangerous if you didn't stand right over it, except for Lindenbaum, who, when he threw it in front of him, threw it and we couldn't see it. Nobody could see, where is it? Suddenly the instructor shouted, "It's behind you!" And we all jumped away, and he'd thrown it behind him. He did things like this several times. That's why I so admire Priestley. He was scared. Again and again, he fell from a rope during an assault course. He was scared. He froze at our first jump, and the instructor had to lift him off into the glory hole. And yet he went into action. I never went to action. This man went into action and was dropped into the enemy. You know the story of Priestley, don't you? And I think that's much braver than someone like me who didn't imagine. I lacked imagination. I couldn't imagine that something was happening. I probably would react quite well. My reactions were fairly quick, but I had no imagination in advance. So I wasn't brave. My lack of fear was due to my lack of understanding, if you'd like to put it like that.
Did you sense that was part of his particular fear, rather than, you know, heights or things like that? He was thinking about what...
I don't know what it was. I do know on a number of occasions he suddenly acted in fear. Mm. When we learnt to throw Mills bombs, what do you call them, hand grenades, did exactly the same. We were behind a wall about 3 sandbags high, and we were told to throw them the way you throw a cricket ball. As none of us had ever played cricket, this was very funny. But it was thrown overhead, so we threw them and watched them explode. And when he threw his, we couldn't see it anywhere. It went right vertically up. He'd let go too soon. Part of it was perhaps a clumsiness, I don't know. And we ran. Because it came down, it actually came down in front of the sandbags. Just, it wouldn't have come on our side, but even so, it might not have been very attractive to be close behind the sand, on the other side of the sandbag. That's, and I made fun of him. On the blackboard, I always put, "Where is Lindenbaum?" That was his German name, and I had put little cartoons of these events. In a football match, he was standing by the side. But he was a good-hearted fellow, and we were quite good friends. And he never was cross with me about it.
you're saying about the fuses, that was probably...
Yes, the fuses was the first step. Then we learned to put the fuse into a primer, and then came the gelignite.
Was this at Arisaig, the gelignite?
Now, I'm not sure how far we got at Arisaig, and I'm not sure of that at all. I really cannot remember. And you can... I did not make notes. I kept... What diary I kept was purely personal matters, without any reference to my training and so on, because I took that serious, as security aspect. And
did your diary writing change then when you started?
Yeah, first of all, it changed in the sense that instead of writing it regularly, I would write 2 or 3 weeks later and catch up. Secondly, I did not write about what we were doing. As far as I know, never. During training. In Italy, I did write a little bit about some things, but I used a code. And as soon as the war collapsed, I quickly wrote down what those codes meant. And that was lucky, because now I had forgotten. And when I found that page where I'd written down what they meant. And there's still two words that I couldn't find out what I'd meant by them. And so I don't quite know how far we got, because I don't quite... I think from Arisaig, we went to Northampton. That was our next... You probably know better than I. Outside Northampton, it doesn't really matter at this point. It may, but gelignite. I do remember that gelignite, when we handled gelignite, although we wore gloves and everything, and the first time we set off a gelignite charge, I got that headache they'd warned us of. Although I hadn't actually. That's the sheer smell of it. Or smell of course these particles going into your nose. So I suppose I was too close to it. And of course we were told that the primer was very sensitive, so we had to be very careful about that. And but around that time plastic came into being, and plastic was quite safe. You could knead it and it wasn't so sensitive. I mean, you had to be careful to a certain extent. And it was not dangerous to you. It didn't give you any headaches. It was more like plasticine. It's wonderful, you know. You could shape it to fit. And we learned how to do explosives that could... Limpets, called limpets, that could be stuck onto the side of a boat. We had to swim under water and stick it onto the boat and set the fuse, giving yourself enough seconds to get away.
Was that when you were up in Arisaig?
I don't think so. I'm not sure. I have a feeling... I don't know. It would be silly of me to guess.
The other thing would be unarmed combat.
Unarmed combat. That we did at Arisaig quite a lot. And that I enjoyed particularly. I was actually very good at it.
Do you remember your instructors?
No.
Who they may have been?
No.
And what sort of form did that training take?
What sort of form? First of all, every day we had to do this for several minutes and several times a day to harden the edge of our hands for what they call the edge of the hand blow, which was for going for the side of the neck of the other person. But we were told that we shouldn't do that if the other person wore a helmet. And then we learned actions, unarmed combat actions. One was what they call the matchbox blow, so-called because it was useful to have something like a matchbox into your fist, and you hit against the side, the top, by the side of the eye of the person in front of you. And if you didn't signal it, it was bound to be very effective. And apparently it could kill a man. And there was a story of a soldier in another camp who, as he walked out of the camp going out, had forgotten to report to the guardhouse, and the guard sergeant came up behind me and tackled him, hey, and he automatically, having just done a whole hour of unarmed combat, turned round the way he had been taught and killed the sergeant just because of this training. We had to do these things, and we had to be both the victim and the, for instance, you had to lie on the side of a pathway and the victim had to come by, and you had to jump up behind him, knee into the back of the small of the back, hand over his face and hand into his side as if you had a knife just underneath the ribs, if I remember rightly. I'm not sure. That was another one. Then there was the matchbox blow was connected with the knee into the groin, into the in between the legs, so that you had this double effect. Then we learned how to deal with somebody who held a gun, a pistol or a revolver at you, and because we were told never to come near enough to a person if we were sticking someone up, and if we did, to shoot if he started coming nearer, not to hesitate, because it was because if they had learned unarmed combat, once they came near enough, you can. There were two ways of either you did this automatically, whether you were told to or not, and you either came down, depending on which hand he held it down, with your right hand, and at the same time turned sideways, so that if the gun went off, it didn't hit you, or you came down with your left hand, hitting it right downwards. So with a bit of luck, it hit his own foot on you, and you twist it along. And we learned a very interesting way of making someone follow you. The police method, we were told, was to twist your arm and hold it upwards in your back. What we were told was much more sophisticated. It required the ability to be near to your victim and get your thumb in between his thumb and fingers, and then with one very, very quick twist, you held him so that if he moved, he did anything he didn't like, you would break his thumb. And it was very painful, and we tried it out on each other, and just holding it, just being held like that, was very painful. That's about all I remember about unarmed combat, but two or three of these things I've still kept well in mind. When I go out late at night, I sometimes carry my keys like this in my hand if I go out to the post box.